Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with David Drake and Jamie Knack. David, a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. David, good to have you back.
Good morning, Larry.
Jamie Knack is a UW Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. And Jamie, nice to see your smiling face as well. Welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. It's really nice to be on the show again. Thank you.
So we're talking with these experts about a lot of things in the outdoors, but one of them is Wisconsin bats. We'll also take a look at spring migrations and certainly look forward to your questions and comments as we move along. Maybe your wildlife photos as well. We love those as well. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. The Wisconsin DNR puts out a bat newsletter. I think it's called Echolocator. And what does it share about how volunteers support the work of DNR biologists? I thought it was pretty cool, actually. David, go ahead.
Yeah, so they put out a newsletter called Echolocator after the unique ability of bats to echolocate, where they send out sound waves and then they receive those sound waves back. And depending on what the sound wave is bounced off of, they can determine how far away it is, roughly, you know, the size of it and things like that. And so that's the name of the newsletter, for the reason for the name of the newsletter. And the DNR has been pretty, pretty wise and clever about how they use citizen scientists to collect bat data across the state. And a good example of that is that they will have a training program so that citizen scientists can actually get a device where they can record the echolocations of all the bat species in the state of Wisconsin. And then they can determine, based on a number of algorithm computer-based programs, they can determine what species it was that was heard calling on the recording device. These volunteers run known transect routes, so they have a good sense about where bats, the presence and absence of different species in the state, and things like that. And the citizens, I think, have a really good time. So, you know, they'll do it. They'll run the transect via vehicles, bicycles, on foot. They're out in canoes and kayaks because bats utilize a lot of aquatic habitat, both to drink water, but also to utilize the food sources with aquatic insects and things like that. So it's a pretty clever way of being very efficient in collecting a wide range of data.
Well, as we look at the threats, we have four hibernating bat species in the state, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, yep, that's
threats,
correct.
Yeah, what threats? A white nose is certainly commonly talked about. There, maybe talk about that or other threats that may exist.
Yeah, so we have eight total species in the state of Wisconsin in terms of bat species. Four of the bat species migrate from the state, spend the winter being active in warmer climates in southern parts of the United States. And then we have four species that hibernate, and that's their strategy to survive the wintertime. And they are actually what we call the resident species. They stay here in the state of Wisconsin, but they sleep through the winter. And those resident species, when they go into these hibernaculum, be it a cave or a mine system, they're the ones who are susceptible to white nose syndrome. And white nose syndrome has been going on in the United States since about 2006, and it was first found in a cave system out around Albany, New York. It was first discovered here in Wisconsin in 2014. And white nose syndrome is this insidious non-native fungus that grows in these cave systems, in these hibernaculums, and it attacks bats. And so it will disrupt their hibernation, so it causes them to wake up from hibernation. And as they do that, they have to expend a lot of energy to wake back up and become active. And so they can burn through energy stores that they've put on to sleep through the winter. And then if they go back into hibernation, they may not have enough energy to survive the rest of the hibernation season. The other issue sometimes that occurs is as they wake up, they're disoriented. And so they'll actually fly outside the hibernaculum into the outdoors where they're susceptible to hypothermia. And then the last thing that happens typically is that they will they will die of dehydration. And so there's a number of ways that white nose syndrome will kill them. And unfortunately, what's going on in Wisconsin since 2014 is it looks like every hibernaculum in the state now has been infected with white nose syndrome, where they've surveyed. And the longer that a bat or the population of bats resides in that hibernaculum, the longer they reside in that hibernaculum that has maintained white nose syndrome, the more death or mortality that occurs. And so, for example, they had a hibernaculum that 6 years after it was first discovered of white nose syndrome, I think on average 89% of the bats are dead in that hibernaculum after 6 years. So it's a really unfortunate disease. And the other issue with bats is we don't know a lot about them. They are a slow reproducing species. They don't, at the most, they might have three pups. Most species only have one pup each year. We don't know much about how pup survival into adulthood. We don't know about adult survival. We don't know generally demographics about what the sex ratio is a lot of times. And in addition to white nose syndrome, there's other mortalities going on in terms of other types of diseases, natural predation. And bats are also susceptible to mortality from wind farms, of which we've got a decent number of wind farms and wind turbines in the state of Wisconsin.
So lots of things there. I guess that's why it's important to sort of monitor and manage the population. But I don't know. I don't know how you manage a population like that.
Yeah, it's a Jamie, jump in here if you want.
I'd be happy to. I was just going to actually encourage listeners. There's a number of things that you can do as a individual to help the bat population. And I know the year would not have been the year it was for the bat program. There's three biologists in that program doing the work of, for the state. And so they rely heavily on volunteers. And it was just a huge effort, especially with COVID and limitations and guidelines that staff needed to follow, where folks were still able to work within their family unit to do this monitoring, both the acoustic monitoring that David was talking about, but also come summer here when we monitor summer roosts. So that's a count of bats as they emerge from their summer roost location. So I just wanted to put a information out there to the listeners. If you'd like to get involved, if you just go to the Department of Natural Resources website and look at the bat program or type in bat monitoring, there are ways for you to sign up. And other things are just being aware and sharing information. So for example, if you do see a bat flying around in the winter months here now, keep tabs of that. You can report sick or dead bats also into the system that they can potentially collect some carcasses and see what's going on. But it could again be a note regarding what's going on with white nose syndrome in the general area. And then lastly, we are getting close to the point where bats awaken from their hibernating. So end of March into April, we'll start to see bats, and perhaps you'll start to hear them in an attic or an outbuilding. And there is a time frame at which you can be evicting bats. So putting in one-way doors to get the bats to leave the attic and then repair those openings. But there's a very specific time period when you're not legally able to, because these cave bats, especially the little brown and big brown bats that are common in attics, are protected or a threatened species in the state. So between June 1st and August 15th, you cannot do any of this exclusion without a special permit. And you're kind of in that window. So come April, May, that's a short window that you could potentially be doing some of that excluding of bats in homes and barns and so on. So just wanted to share some of those things to be thinking about.
Well, that's a good information there about bats. Appreciate that information from both of you, and let our listeners join in here. We have lots of emails, don't have any calls yet, but you can join in with your own questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Joe emailed to say they always heard spring is a good time to clean out birdhouses. Joe's observed a black-capped chickadee around one of their houses. Should he leave that house alone so he doesn't disturb the birds, or is it okay to clean it out? Jamie?
Sure. I had that on my list of spring cleaning or things to talk about for spring, and that would be, yes, get out there and clean out your birdhouses. In the case of a chickadee already there, probably looking at assessing that potential nest site. I don't think it would be too late for you to just go ahead and open up that house and remove any nesting material. Those birds, tree swallows, bluebirds, chickadees, they're going to want to bring in their own nesting material. So it's really great if you can get in there and remove what's there. It's kind of a favorite time of the year when we hit early March for my kids. We love to go on the in the backyard and clean out all of our nest boxes, because usually there's some excitement with some deer mice or white-footed mice that come jumping out and have taken up the home of that birdhouse over the winter. So anyway, really important to go in there and remove that material. For species like wood ducks or some of the owls that you can use artificial nest boxes, you can go in there and clean out any eggs that perhaps didn't hatch or droppings and things like that. But usually you want to leave some shavings, wood shavings in the bottom of that nest box. And of course, with wood duck houses, you always need to leave a way for them to get out of the box. So usually wire hardware cloth that's stapled to the inside, or just gouging it with a screwdriver so that those ducklings are able to climb out of the box and fledge.
We should
mention right now we have a number of owl species who are either finishing up nesting or are nesting. So don't disturb the owl boxes yet. Right. Wait for a couple more months before you do anything with the owl boxes.
John in Eagle emailed to ask how do possums survive? He can walk right up to them and they just sort of stop and look at him. They're slow. They don't have big claws. He says he would find the predators would get to them in no time at all, David.
Well, yes. And that old adage of playing dead like a possum applies here. And that's one of the things, one of their strategies. And if you come across them, a lot of times they'll hiss at you. They may try to scurry up a tree. They're very good climbers. With that tail and their opposable thumbs. And then if that doesn't work, they may just play dead. And a lot of times predators don't feed on dead animals. They typically feed on live animals. And so hopefully the plain dead will kind of disinterest predator. But possums are kind of an interesting animal. They're the only marsupial we have in the entire United States. And so a marsupial, obviously, it would be like a kangaroo where they – the possums have a pouch, and so after the young are born, they climb into the pouch, and that's where they spend most of their early days growing. But the other thing about possums is they really are at the very the extent of their northern range, and to some extent they've exceeded their northern range here in Wisconsin. And so possums, if you've looked at them carefully, they don't have fur on their ears or on their tail, and they are active year-round up here, so they're active throughout the winter. So that really, really cold stretch of winter we just came through about for that 2-week stretch a couple weeks ago, those possums will really struggle. And possums that have been around for a while, it's not unusual to see them with notches out of their ears or part of their tail missing, because that exposed skin has frozen due to frostbite and has died, and then that tissue has fallen off their body. So possums are an interesting animal, but I'm not sure I'd want to be a possum up here in the winter of Wisconsin, that's for sure.
Yeah, and playing dead wouldn't work very good if it was an eagle that was after you.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man. David Drake and Jamie Knack, our guests today. Great to have them on to talk about the world of wildlife. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. Jana Rose Slice, our producer today. Let's see, who is our... Oh, Christina Myshock's our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of wildlife with David Drake and Jamie Knack from the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. David also as part of a UW Extension as well. So great to have them with us. Again, questions... Email your questions or comments to ideas@wpr.org or phone us at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to the phones, a couple of photos. Lindsay and Stevens Point emailed to say they discovered a flying squirrel visiting their bird feeder. And Lindsay's curious how common they are, and do they fly in the city, and do they hibernate? So a few questions about flying squirrels. Jamie, let's go to you.
So in the state, we have two species of flying squirrels, a northern flying squirrel and a southern flying squirrel. And what's interesting is that southern flying squirrel is extends its range into the very northern parts of the state. So that when we're doing our summer field course with our wildlife ecology students, when we're trapping and teaching them techniques to trap and handle these animals, we have only ever caught southern flying squirrels, and that's in the Minocqua area. So two species, they don't actually fly. They can't flap their skin like a bird flaps its wing and maintain or increase their height. But what they're able to do is glide. So they'll climb, for instance, an oak tree, maybe a stag, a standing dead tree that has cavities that they would nest in or have their young in. And when it jumps from that tree, it can move to another tree. Between its wrists on its legs is a flap of skin called a patagium. And when they jump, they spread that out much like a parachute, and it catches that air, and they're able to glide from tree to tree. So they don't spend, they will forage on the ground, but they quickly will run up a tree if any danger is in the area. So pretty common throughout the state, but the big thing with flying squirrels is they're nocturnal. So just they're similar habits to our tree squirrels, our gray squirrel and our fox squirrel, but they're just doing that activity at night. So oftentimes people first detect a flying squirrel when they're walking around the neighborhood at dusk or maybe feeding birds, and they look out at their bird feeder and they see a blur of something, and chances are that was a flying squirrel coming in to feed at that bird feeding station, or, you know, gliding from tree to tree as they're going for a walk. But cute little buggers. In terms of hibernating, they'll cache food. I'm not sure, David. Are they a true hibernator?
No, they don't. Yeah. They're active year round. So
right.
Yep.
So both they might cache and store some food away, but still going to be out and about, again, just doing that at night when we're sleeping.
Let's go to Claire in Baraboo next. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Larry and David and Jamie. Thank you. Before I ask my question, I would love also for you guys to comment on the value of trees. People working up, a lot of chainsaws going in my area, and that really disturbs me. I hate to see trees going. But the reason why I called was, and it just happened this morning, I looked up and I saw flying not too high over the treetops three very large birds, and their undersides were light mottled feathers. I would guess they were either owls or hawks. They were definitely not cranes. But what made me really take a double take was I don't think I've ever seen hawks or owls flying in a cluster of three. So is that because it's spring, or any ideas what I saw?
Sure. David, do you want to take that?
Yeah, so thank you, Claire, for your question. I thought you were going to say sandhill crane, because I was just out for a run this morning, and then I decided to walk on the ice of Lake Mendota with a friend of mine, and we saw sandhill cranes flying over and heard them. It's a little unusual for hawks and owls. I mean, owls wouldn't be typically out in the daytime like this unless it's maybe a snowy owl, but it would be unusual to see three owls or hawks flying in a kind of a formation like that. So I'm wondering if you didn't see maybe some kind of a goose species, either a snow goose or a lesser Canada goose or something of that nature. Maybe look those species up and see if that's not what you saw or heard overhead. Was it maybe a goose size?
We lost her.
Okay. So that's what I would suggest, is maybe look up a couple of different goose species. And then in terms of the trees, I will just mention this, that I there are a lot of chainsaws going right now. There's a lot of people looking for projects to do. I wouldn't be too concerned about it. Hopefully those chainsaws are going to eliminate a lot of invasive non-native trees. And so that could be a possibility. But the other issue is, you know, trees do need to be maintained. They need to be pruned. And a lot of times if trees are cut down, they'll either regrow or there's been replanting. But trees do need to be maintained in order to maintain their healthiness. So possibly they may not necessarily be cutting the trees down. They might be maintaining the trees. And this is a good time to do that before they start growing new leaves and shoots and things of that nature.
Yeah, could be ash trees as well.
Yeah,
unfortunately.
Yeah, ash board. That's right.
Noreen in Watertown, let's go to you now. Hi, Noreen.
Hi. Thanks, Larry, for having me. I was really excited to hear that you were talking about bats, because we have had bats in our house since we moved in 4 years ago. And so we've actually seen in that time 4 bats coming into the house, and have had to try to get them outdoors. 2 of them were dead. And so I'm just wondering about the behaviors as well, because one of them I found in the morning in the sink. So we're not sure exactly what happened. It was floating in water, dead. And then during the winter time as well, we keep hearing them up in the attic, and we've tried excluding them ourselves, and we're going to finally hire professionals, but we hear like a very fast drumming sound. And so I was wondering, is that also just part of, I've seen like specials where they say that squirrels and chipmunks, or not squirrels, but chipmunks will shake in the winter while they're hibernating to keep warm. And I didn't know maybe if that's what the bats were doing. So any thoughts about the behavior would be great.
Jamie, what about it?
Yeah. Thanks for the call and sharing your observations. Noreen, the sounds people typically hear from a bat roost are maybe some little squeaks, but mostly it's like scratching. It's them moving around or repositioning or moving throughout the walls. Otherwise, you know, there's not a lot that they make for an audible sound. First of all, you shouldn't really tolerate having bats in your home. Even if that is in your attic, it's something that you would like, you know, you do want to, exclude them, and excluding them is the only 100% way, you know, through bat proofing the home to be rid of that colony. We talked about earlier how they're protected, and there's certain time windows when you can and can't legally exclude these bats because of their protected status. So you will have a window here this spring as they start to emerge to take steps to exclude them. I'd like to point you to the Department of Natural Resources. If you go to their website and type in bat exclusion, they have a really nice document on step-by-step process for excluding bats. And if you decide that it's more than you really want to handle, or you've attempted it before without, you know, success, you can reach out to a pest control company and ask them if they work with bats, and ask them about, you know, make sure you talk to them about this this time period where it's illegal, and how do they do it, and, you know, look at what kind of a contract they have, and then consider hiring somebody to do that work. As far as bats flying around in the living quarters, so on your first or second story where you occupy, again, that's probably bats trying to explore or leave that roost and getting into the living area. That's not usually where they want to be. They don't want to be with, you know, associated with us. And typically they're going to be in the highest part of your house where we have the warmest temperatures. So at the peaks in your attics, or if you have a barn or outbuilding, you're going to find them at the very top. So again, I definitely would point you to some resources on the DNR's page. They have some nice information and pictorials to go along with it.
There you go, Noreen. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Mike in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. I have a comment about bats, and then I have a quick question about owls. With the bats, a couple of years ago, we had bats that got into our house, and so we did hire a professional, and they did an excellent job of excluding the bats and then also blocking the entrances, which is probably just as important as excluding them. But they did a great job, and I learned so much about bats. It was really interesting. My question is this a good time of year to be putting up a new owl nest box?
David, do you want to take that?
Yeah, sure. So, Mike, thank you for the information about the bats. I'm glad you learned a lot about them. They are a fascinating animal, without a doubt, and it's not uncommon for them to be in people's houses. So, in terms of owl boxes, it probably is a little late for you to put those up. Great horned owls, for example, are the earliest nesting species of bird we have in the state of Wisconsin. And so they're nesting, you know, by the end of January or so. But you can put them up and you know, sometimes it takes animals a while to find them, get used to them. So you can put them up and maybe the owls will start exploring them now, even though they might not nest in them. The one issue about putting up a nest box, you might get other things in there like raccoons, or you might get some squirrels or some other things in there as well. So, but that is not the worst thing in the world either. So if you want to put the nest box up now, please go ahead and do that if that's a convenient time for you to do it. But for in terms of an owl actually using it for this nesting season, it would probably be pretty unlikely.
Okay, Jamie, did I add to that?
I was just going to add, if you're just antsy and looking for a woodworking project, now is a great time to build a summer bat roosting box and to get that out on the landscape. Now's the perfect time for putting those out.
Or bluebird boxes as well, or something like that too, yeah. Yep. That's a good point.
And a lot of those plans are on the DNR website?
Yeah, again, really nice. Yep, again, really nice step-by-step set of directions and supplies needed and so on. So, yep.
Yeah, it also, Bat Conservation International has a wonderful resource on their website about bat boxes. So go to Bat Conservation International is another place to go. And the North American Bluebird Association also has great designs for bluebird boxes.
Yeah, and you have to be careful with those bluebird boxes. You need to get everything right. Or as somebody said, you can turn them into owl feeders if the holes aren't correct. Well, Rod in Arlington, it's your turn.
Hi, how are you today? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure
I don't
thing.
Normally do this, but went outside yesterday to get mail, and a bird had apparently been eaten by a predator bird, but these wings are much larger than I would ever expect to see. We have feeders out here with blue jays and cardinals and all types of different birds that feed during the winter. These wings that were ripped out of this bird, one of them is about 12 inches long. The other one is about 8. And they have some interesting markings, but I can't quite figure out what they are. And I've searched it out on the Internet but haven't been able to come up with one. And I was hoping maybe you could give me a location where I could text or email pictures. And maybe you could give me an idea what these are. I'm wondering if they weren't a hawk of some type.
Yeah,
you
and
could
it's,
email
it's
them.
Possible. Yeah,
I'm gonna say
I'm
you could
sorry.
Email them right now if you want to, and we can take a look at them. Go to ideas@wpr.org/Larry, and you or just email them to us, and we can take a look. But go ahead, Jamie. Sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say one of the things to keep in mind if this was near a road. I thought that's what you said, but it's possible that it was a vehicle collision, and not a predatory action. So, it could have been a bird that was hit by a car or some other event.
Yep, that's what I was thinking too, Jamie. Is maybe an owl that was hit by a car and perhaps scavenged by another animal, even.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or sharpshooter coopers.
Mm-hmm. And just happened to make it far enough before it died to make it to your area there. Yep,
yeah,
there you go, Rod. Thank you for calling. Bob in Albion Township, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi, I'm enjoying your show very much. I have two questions. My wife and I live on a small lake there in southeastern Dane County, and this winter we set up a trail cam, and one of the first things we saw was a bobcat. And I wondered how unusual that is in Dane County. And then another thing we've seen in the early evening fairly often, particularly when it was very, very cold, is deer coming out, walking out from the edges into the middle of the lake in pretty good numbers, sometimes a dozen. And what are they doing? They seem to be just nosing around. Are they drinking in the snow? That's my questions.
Okay, thank you very much for calling. Jamie, we'll go to you.
Yeah, Bob, I'm happy to help with the first one, and I'll throw the second one to David because I don't have a clue. But we can hypothesize on that one. But Bob, is so interesting. You talk about trail cameras. First of all, for anybody who doesn't have one, they are so much fun. It is so cool to see what animals are moving around on your property, in your backyard, when you're not there. It's just really eye-opening and certainly fun. And if you have kids, it's a fun activity to involve them in. But this morning, we got a call at our house that somebody had found a bobcat on, this would be on Highway 151 up by Columbus, and he had sent a picture, and we confirmed that that was in fact what it was. So we're up northeast of Madison on 151. So that was a bobcat up in that area. And it wasn't too long ago, if you're familiar with where the diesel driving school is, in that general location, that a bobcat was sighted. So bobcats, their populations are doing really well in the state, 4,000 to 5,000, if I had to just throw a number out there. But we are seeing more and more bobcats in the southern part of the state of Wisconsin. So there's been a recent deer predation study that has occurred in the southwestern part of the state where I think the goal was 30 bobcats to put radio collars on and follow around their movements and what they were doing in that area. So it's still very unusual, or rather rare, because they are pretty secretive, but not all that uncommon anymore to capture them on your trail camera. So, but very, very cool sighting. And as far as the deer being out on the lake in northern Wisconsin, Scott Craven's on the show opposite of us. And on his lake, he would talk about deer being out on the lake, and you know, we hypothesized that might be a predator behavior.
Yep.
But down here, I'm not sure. David, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I they very well might still be a predator behavior, because they can see the animals coming at them from a long way away. And a lot of the predator avoidance, regardless of what the species is, if you're an item of prey, that's genetically wired into you. So you would exhibit probably similar predator avoidance behavior to some extent. You know, the other possibility that they may be out there, maybe there's some kind of a mineral that's in there, that there's a mineral lick that they're on, or something of that nature. They might be out there drinking. They might just be out there just kind of exploring as well. And as Jamie mentioned, it's not unusual for deer to be on lakes. And every so often you hear, unfortunately, of deer falling through the ice and being rescued by humans and things of that nature. But what exactly they're doing out there, that's a good question. But those would be my guesses as well, Jamie, is predator avoidance. It's just a safe place to be, especially in a group. And maybe there's something out there that's attracting them as well. Maybe, there's some food that's out there, especially if people are ice fishing. There's all sorts of things left on the ice when people abandon that hole at the end of the day. So they might be out there for that as well.
Jolie from Mosinee called to ask about eagle nesting. When does it usually happen?
Yeah, so usually it will happen later into the spring. So, about April or so, into March they start nesting through April into May. So, and again, it probably depends on where in the state. Obviously, it'll occur a little bit sooner down here in the southern part of the state than it would up in the northern part of the state. Northern part of the state, typically, it'll wait until that ice starts clearing off the lakes and things of that nature, so there's a food source available for those eagles to utilize.
Jane in Wausau emailed to say they saw a good-sized bear yesterday as it was crossing a farm field. It seems early for the bear to be out and about. Is that the case?
They're not necessarily a true hibernator. They can wake up. It depends on how you define hibernation, but they can wake up and climb out of the den and move around, and perhaps that bear will go back to that den or even a new den and lay up again for a number of weeks here, and especially depending on what we have for weather going into March. But probably, my guess is an exploratory movement looking for some food, and we'll probably go back to that den for a while.
Sue and Dave in LaGrange, let's go there. Hi.
Hi. Hi, how are you doing?
Good, yeah, appreciate the call.
We live in the Kettle Moraine area in Walworth County, and we've been there for almost 30 years. And last year, for the first time, we saw some nighthawks flying around. Yep. And then a couple of days later, we saw literally hundreds of them. I was cutting some grass in a field, and it seemed like they were following the bugs around as I was cutting the grass. It was just amazing watching these things for a good half hour swooping around. Just wondering how common is that?
David, do you want to take that?
Yeah. So Dave, what time of the year were you watching that?
This was probably September last year.
Yeah. Yep. So they're migrating through at that period of time. They'll start migrating through, maybe the mid to late August, something like that. And a lot of times they'll follow dragonfly migrations and other flying insect migrations, and they'll feed on those animals or those insects as they migrate south. And so, obviously, nighthawks, they're a nocturnal species. A lot of times as the sun starts going down, you'll see them in the sky. But when you see groups of them, as you described it, that they're in a migratory formation or pattern at that particular time, flying south for the winter, and they're feeding on the wing as they go. And certainly if the field was being disturbed through a mowing exercise or something like that, as you start mowing, you're starting to stir up a whole host of insects that are coming out of that grass. And so they certainly would have been feeding on that. And again, as tall grass is being mowed or hayed, it's not unusual to see hawks work in the mowing line, or you'll see other insectivorous birds that are feeding in front of that mower. Or if you prescribe burn fields, you'll see that where the fire line is. A lot of birds are working that fire line because there's a lot of prey or a lot of food that's moving in front of that fire line as well. So, yeah, that's a pretty neat sighting. And, it's not uncommon.
Aaron works for the DNR. He emailed a really cool photo. He emailed to say they were driving up to the bat condo to install another bat house when they heard this show. Aaron shared a photo of the bat condo and a house at Peshtigo Harbor Wildlife Area. They're monitored by the volunteer citizen scientists, and last year they reported seeing nearly 500 bats using the condo. That is pretty cool. Very cool picture.
Yeah, thanks so much for chiming in, Aaron. And ironic, we're talking about the same things today. So, but that's a great picture, and that's a very large colony house. You can certainly build smaller roost boxes as well if you don't want to undertake a project to that degree. But lots of friends groups get together and raise money and have them at some of the state parks or natural areas as well. So cool.
David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests today as we talk the world of wildlife. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Talking the world of wildlife today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests, David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Jamie Nack, Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist with UW in that same Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. So great to have them with us. Questions or comments, call us at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. John in Brown Deer has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you for accepting my call. And I would like to know if either David or Jamie can tell me what the largest species of skunk is in Wisconsin, because I believe I have a skunk that's living under a concrete stoop in my backyard, and I saw it one morning scrambling around in my front bushes, and I went to my rear window, and sure enough, it found its way back into its den. But to me, this thing must weigh about 20 pounds. It's a huge skunk.
It's a big one. It's a big one. Jamie, what do you think?
Well, I appreciate the call. And the question was about species, but I understand it more to be about individuals. What's the record? So we at one time had two species of skunks, the striped skunk and the spotted skunk. I can't tell you the last time there was a record of a spotted skunk. I think there's always hope with the Snapshot Wisconsin Trail Camera Project that somebody will maybe get a picture of a spotted skunk, but they're more of a Western species. We're kind of on the edge of their range. Anyway, it is amazing. If you live in an urban area, perhaps this skunk has been fattened up by taking advantage of, you know, whether it be trash or bird feed, has just really packed on the pounds. So they don't hibernate, but they do den up, much like raccoons and possums, and then come out on warmer, sunnier days to forage again. But the other thing would be just, I'm thinking about our long-haired cats in the house, and if they fluff up to show like defense or to look larger, it's amazing how much that fur will appear to add to their overall size. So I suspect if it saw you, it probably fluffed up a little bit. But otherwise it's healthy and eating well, but I don't know, maybe there is a record book somewhere. But yeah, interesting sighting. So.
Yeah. I don't imagine many people go around weighing skunks just to see how much they weigh. So, man, John, thanks a lot. That was a fun call too. Well, they're all great calls. Marcus in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Marcus.
Yeah, am I on? Oh, it's off.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thanks, Larry. I love your show. Anyway, So I live in East Green Bay, upper apartment in a nice complex, and I have a balcony. And one night, evening, my cat was all freaked out. He jumped up on the railing, and there was scratching in the soffit area, if you understand. It's an overhang by my mm-hmm. balcony. Yeah, holy cow. So anyway, it was bats. And then I talked to a neighbor, you know, not about that. But anyway, so they had some bat guy come in and exterminate them. And he sealed off the openings. They get in under the shingles because the roof is, the shingles are bad. And they crawl up there. And I love the bats. And so I would sit carefully near my window, and I would see him take off, and it was just wonderful. So anyway, I'm thinking of getting a bat house. But anyway, yeah, that's my comment.
Well, thank you, Marcus. Yeah, thank you so much for calling. He's looking for a bat house, and again, maybe just mention again, Jamie, where, you know, Marcus wants to build his own, perhaps, where can he...
So Marcus, if you'd like to build your own, I would certainly put you towards the Department of Natural Resources, so the DNR's website, and just type in bat houses, and that'll get you to the page. They will have very detailed instructions, and I guess we can't reiterate enough, whether you're building a birdhouse or a bat box, there has been a lot of research that goes into those designs, and in terms of which ones are the most effective, and you really ought to follow those kind of approved plans. And the other source is the Bat Conservation International website. So that's just bci.org. And the other option is you can purchase your own bat house if you don't want to or don't care to build one. But what you want to look for in the description is that it is BCI certified or approved, because then it was built to those specifications. So, and if you do an internet search for bat houses, I'm sure you will find a number of different sources and options.
But that BCI is important.
Yeah, I'm just going to mention also, if you want to buy one, Wild Birds Unlimited usually sells them, as do some other places. But that I've gotten hung up on that BCI.org. It's actually batcon.org.
So oh, yeah.
Sorry. Bat and then con.org rather than BCI. But that's tripped okay. me up a couple times as well, Jamie.
And just to go along with this, Jim in Boston emailed to ask, where is the best place to hang a bat house?
So if you go to Bat Conservation International or the DNR website, they have a lot of very good information on where to set a bat house. But typically you want it to be 10 to 30 or so feet off the ground. So a lot of times it's difficult to get 30 feet up off the ground if you don't have climbing gear or a lift or something like that. So, you know, 10 to 15 feet off the ground, if you can have the front of the bat house generally oriented toward a south facing direction, that would be ideal. If it's a single chamber bat house, you want to put that against a building or against your house, because that single chamber bat house doesn't have enough insulation to actually protect the bats from some cool weather. If it's a multi-chambered house, you could put it on a pole, or you can put it along a tree or adhere it to a tree. If you adhere it to a tree, you want to make sure that you are have the ability to ease off on whatever's holding the bat house to the tree, so you're not girdling the tree growth. And you also don't want that bat house to be underneath a branch so that predators can get off the branch or from the branch to the bat house. And there's a couple other things, you know, nuances and things like that about location, but those are the general ones. And again, if you go to the DNR website or Bat Conservation International, they've got some very, very good advice and guidance about bat house placement.
Jake in Madison has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jake.
Hello. Yeah, thanks a lot for the show. I had a birdhouse question, but first a quick little possum story. I was sitting in my backyard, and the mother possum is walking by me on my little path, just a foot away from me, and six little babies following, and the mother smells my feet and keeps walking, and each little baby stopped and looked at me and then kept walking too. Pretty adorable little animals.
Oh, great, great experience. Well, what's your question
So I'm thinking birdhouses. How many different species do you think, like, your average yard can maintain kind of without them fighting?
David, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd say it really depends quite a bit on what's in your yard. So, you know, the more vegetation you have in your yard and the more different types of vegetation, especially and preferably native vegetation, the more species that you have the potential to actually attract and hold in your yard. So in addition to vegetation, it also has to do with, you know, different types of food availability in terms of food abundance, food diversity, possible water source availability, and things like that. And then it also has to do with the size of your yard. So it really depends quite a bit. But, you know, again, if you are in a typical suburban residential community, you'd probably be pretty surprised about the diversity of the birds, especially if you have some established vegetation in that community with maybe, you know, a water source nearby and things like that. I bet you probably could get, especially during springtime migration, things like that, I wouldn't be surprised if you could get, you know, 25% of the bird species in the state to be found in your area.
Jamie, to add to that?
Yeah, I guess I took a different take on the question. I'm off on that, but I thought you were asking maybe about how many bird nest boxes you could put in the yard and what you could expect for species.
Yeah.
Well, David's really correct. So, and just the habitat that you have to offer is going to play a lot into what you can expect to be there. But if you're in just a city lot in town, I would certainly suggest that you put up a wren house. And they'll be territorial. We have on the home that we have them on opposite corners of the house, so in different side yards. And we usually have both of those boxes occupied. And then I would look to something just like a traditional birdhouse. You have to have pretty unique or specific habitat to attract bluebirds. But if you do have them in the neighborhood, I wouldn't hesitate to put one up. If bluebirds don't use it, tree swallows will. And so just, you know, any other, you know, standard size bluebird nesting box is worth putting up as well. But in terms of bluebird boxes, if you happen to have more open prairie habitat, they do need to have spacing between those because they are territorial. So you're going to have to spend a little time probably researching the bird species, but start by just looking around the neighborhood in terms of what birds you see that are cavity nesters. So,
yeah, Jamie, that's a good point. And thank you for taking a different perspective on the answer, because I had a different take on it. The only thing I'll add to Jamie's point is that for each species that are cavity nesters, that they require a specific diameter hole, the species specific for that bird box. So you just want to also make sure that you pay attention to that.
Yeah. And it's really cool. Some of the golf courses in the state, I know Portage Golf Course, University Ridge Golf Course, the UW course, have bluebird houses up. And it's really cool to be out playing golf and sometimes see a lot of bluebirds. And it's they're so much fun to see. And we don't seem to see them as often, at least I don't, as often as I'd like to see them. So it's really, really great. Well, our guests today, David Drake and Jamie Knack, are going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. David, of course, Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Jamie, a Wildlife Outreach Specialist with the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Questions for them, give a call at 800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. We have some photos. Oh, Rod sent a photo of those wings that he was talking about. So we'll have our experts look at those and we'll come back with some answers right after this look at the news. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking Wildlife on the program today, Larry Mueller here with my guests Jamie Knack and David Drake. Jamie, UW Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. David's a professor in that department, also an Extension Wildlife Specialist. So, lots of callers online, lots of emails, so I think we can go right back to the phones, and or to the emails first, because Rod from Arlington had called earlier and talked about some bird wings that he found. The rest of the bird had been eaten or it was gone anyway. And he sent a photo of the wings. And what do you think, David? Let me throw it to you first. You've had a chance to look at the photos.
Yeah. Jamie and I were both looking at those. We think that they look like great horned owl wings. Based on the feather pattern and the size of them and things like that. And and I would agree 100% with Jamie's assessment of the situation. What I would guess happened is that the great horned owl probably got hit by a car. And that's not uncommon, where the owls are perhaps roosting above a road and they see a type of prey, a rabbit or a small mammal, move across the road. And they will pounce on that animal and then capture it on the road. And they're so consumed or so busy eating that animal that they don't notice a car coming in. So a lot of times they get hit by cars and they get killed that way. And so I think that's what happened. And that's why the gentleman, Rod, found those feathers. And it just so happened probably to be near his mailbox, unfortunately. So they look like great horned owl wings to us, an owl regardless, but most likely the species of great horned owl. And then the only other thing we would like to mention is that it is illegal to possess those feathers. So Rod, if you want to keep them, don't give out any more personal information than you've already given us. But it is illegal to keep those owl feathers without a permit to do so. And if you want to keep them, I would just suggest to perhaps get in touch with the Department of Natural Resources Conservation Officer in your county, and have them just let them know that you've got them, and have that officer either give you the approval or advise you as to what to do. Jamie, is there anything you want to add?
No, I would just explain the reasoning. So birds are protected under the Federal Migratory Bird Protection Act. And so when you think about hunted species like pheasants or turkeys, your license is your permit to possess those feathers. So once you harvest an animal, it comes into your possession, and your license is essentially what gives you that authorization. So for songbirds, you want to collect, you know, cardinal feathers and blue jay feathers, you technically can't do that because we, you know, the enforcement has to be able to determine how those were acquired. And so birds are protected. And of course, that's because of some of the things that went on in the history and illegal harvest and so on. So anyway, just wanted to add a little context to that.
And speaking of owls, Russ in Stoughton has a question relating to owls. Hi, Russ.
Hi. Great program. I had two bird questions. Number one, how big is an owl box? Is that something a handyman could put together? And where would you hang it, attach it? And my other question is, your common house wrens, I think I read years ago that the male is the one who may scout out 5-6 different locations, crotches of trees or old birdhouses, and then he finally finds a mate and brings her around to these locations, and then she picks out the one and throws out all his old sticks and then actually builds the nest in the one that she decides. Is that true?
All right. Couple of good questions there. Jamie?
Well, I'll start with the wren, and that is correct. The males will try to attract those females by building the most impressive nests and find those locations, and then the female will ultimately decide which house is best, which nest is best, and go from there. So it is pretty interesting, and there's lots of interesting ecology and stories about birds similar to that. So, and I'll maybe kick the other question back to David if he wants.
Yeah, sure. So again, you can find some pretty good owl box designs online, and it really is species specific. So, you know, some of the largest owls we have in our state are great horned owls, barred owls. So obviously, you know, you're going to have a pretty decent sized box. And I had an undergraduate student who built some boxes a number of years ago, just as kind of an independent research project. And I want to say her boxes were at least, you know, these were targeted toward great horned owls and barred owls. And those boxes were at least, I want to say, about a foot and a half to 2 feet tall and probably a good foot or so wide and at least a foot or foot and a half deep. You know, so they're pretty substantial. But then you have some smaller owls like saltwood owls or screech owls that they don't need that large of a box. Because they're a relatively small owl. So it really, it is size dependent, but I think if you go online, you can find some pretty good plans. And again, you know, it's not, it doesn't have to be perfect. And anybody with, I think, a semblance of skill, this would be a great project to do. And certainly you should be pretty successful building an owl box. And they're not, you know, especially the larger ones, they're pretty open in the front. So they're not really like a traditional bird box that you would think of having a small hole. And then the entire box is enclosed with sides and all sides and the roof and things like that. Especially the great horned owl boxes, they're pretty open in the front area.
Let's go to, thanks again, Russ. Let's go to Bob in Washington Island. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call, and we really appreciate your show. We've listened to it for years. I have a question on bats. I have a bat house, and a couple of years ago, I would sit out and watch the bats drop out of it in the evening, and one evening I counted 16 dropping out of it. And I read somewhere where down on the door there's a cave where they would check on the bats, and there were some years ago where there were 3,000 would overwinter in this cave. But with the white nose syndrome, it dropped down to 3 bats. And for the last 2 years, I've had 0 bats. And I wondered if there any way that they're coming back or if another species will take their niche.
Yeah. Sad, David.
Yeah, it certainly is. And you know, the Larry, you had asked a question earlier in the show when we started talking about white nose syndrome, about what people can do. And unfortunately, you know, the individual citizen is pretty limited in what they can do to protect these bat species. And, you know, that there are researchers who are working devilishly right now trying to formulate a vaccine against white nose syndrome. And they're getting closer, but they're not quite there yet. And, you know, and there's some other tactics that are being tried. But unfortunately, it looks like, you know, the bats continue to go back to these ecological traps, if you will, where they continue to go back into these hibernaculum that are loaded with white nose syndrome and the fungus. And so it is likely that that's what you're seeing. Unfortunately, is you're not seeing bats in your area, especially if you're close to a hibernaculum like you described, simply because that hibernaculum is getting experiencing quite a bit of mortality. The good news is that DNR bat ecologists are seeing some recruitment with young bats in these areas where they've had, you know, pretty substantial mortality of white nose syndrome. So they're not quite sure yet if some bats are starting to develop immunity possibly, or if the bats are actually starting to maybe overcome some of the mortality. I think that it's still too early to determine what exactly is going on, but it is encouraging that they're seeing some recruitment in those areas. So maybe you'll see some other bats coming in there from the species you've had there in past. Maybe you'll have some new species come up there, but whatever you could do individually to help bats, by all means, it would be much appreciated.
Yeah, keep that bat house up. You wonder, and I'm sure there's been people looking at, could we go into those caves when the bats aren't there and spray those caves with something or clean those caves somehow to get rid of it? But of course, I suppose if infected bats come back into the cave, it starts all over again.
Yeah, they've explored those ideas. And the problem is, you know, those cave ecosystems are so fragile. And it's almost like, you know, you start unraveling a ball of yarn and you start targeting one thing like the fungus, and you don't know what other direct or indirect consequences that you may have that could be negative and actually create even a worse situation. So I think that, you know, rightfully so, the researchers or managers are being pretty cautious about what can they do to, you know, in terms of not disrupting that ecosystem inside those caves and mines too much.
Yeah, I imagine. And even I bet there's even been thought about building caves that you would build the caves that you could work into cleaning procedures or whatever that would be kind of built into it. I imagine that you're nodding yes, that's even been considered.
Yeah.
Well, Bob, I thank you so much. Keep the bat house going and do what you can. Let's go to Tom in Green Bay. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. I've got a problem with your house wrens. If you're encouraging people and people want to see how many species they can put in their yard, the last thing you want to do is put in a house wren box. Because house wrens, the males will predate every other nesting species you got in your yard by poking holes in eggs all the way up to the size of robins and mourning doves. And I have them nesting in my yard, and I keep them as far away as possible. But wrens are well known for this. Marsh wrens and sedge wrens will actually do their own females, the males will, so they can start over. And house wrens are nice. I love their song, but they are a real problem.
Okay. Well, you agree with that, David?
Well, they are certainly territorial. I haven't heard that issue about them poking holes in eggs before, but you know, there are species of birds as well as other animals that will predate young for a variety of reasons. And so, but I'm not familiar with that necessary practice, but you know, wrens, even if you don't put a nest box up, if you've got cavities in your yard or nearby, you may have wrens anyway. So I understand what he's saying about not trying to promote more wrens by putting up boxes, but you may have wrens there regardless because they are a pretty common species, especially in that suburban area as well. So, and I think, you know, it's one person's trash is another person's treasure, right? So Bob doesn't particularly appreciate the wrens maybe as much as somebody else might. So I think it all depends on what you want in your yard and what you enjoy.
Let's go to Tom in Janesville. Tom, hello.
Well, how are you doing? I live in the country, and I have a lot of woodpeckers here that I feed, and I have a lot of trees. I left a couple of dead ones up for the woodpeckers, and I see them hunting insects on them a lot. But I heard that woodpeckers need to drill a new nest hole every year and do not reuse old nest holes. What can you tell me about that?
Well, David, you're going to pipe in?
not re-drill old nest holes so that they won't reuse the nest hole? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, they drill a new one every year. They do not reuse other
cattle. That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that, actually. I know that's not true for red-cockaded woodpeckers. And red-cockaded woodpeckers, I studied those birds for my PhD research. But red-cockaded woodpeckers are the only species in America of woodpeckers that actually will excavate their cavity in live trees. And it can take them up to 5 years to excavate a cavity. So they don't abandon cavities simply because they've put so much energy and effort into it. But for other species like, flickers or red-bellied woodpeckers or whatever the case might be, they excavate dead trees or dead limbs and trees, which would be easier to excavate. So I don't know the answer to that question, to tell you the truth. I guess it wouldn't surprise me if they did go back to existing cavities year after year, but I don't know that. I don't know. Jamie, do you know?
I was perplexed too. I don't have that answer, and whether it varies, as you mentioned, maybe between species or maybe, a different individual might utilize an abandoned nest. Yeah. But I did want to highlight what Tom was talking about leaving dead trees and where it's safe to do so. It is probably the single most beneficial thing you can do for wildlife on property you own is to leave dead trees standing. They can provide food and shelter for more than 70 species of wildlife in the state throughout their decaying and dying process. And then once that snag does fall to the ground, it continues to provide habitat for amphibians and other smaller animals as it's decomposing. So something very tangible that you can do in your woodlands for wildlife.
Dave in Sauk County, we'll go to you now. Hi, Dave. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a couple questions. I was walking around. There's probably 14 plus inches of snow. And as I'm walking around, I'm noticing what I presume were birds of prey, where wing strikes were on the snow. There are a couple different sizes. I never saw any blood or fur. But so I'm guessing those were birds of prey. But what was interesting, it seemed like it was occurring where deer had walked in the snow. So my guess was that when the deer had stepped in the snow, it made a shallow enough snow that the bird could hear the prey down there and take it, because I don't know how they would do it through 14 inches of snow.
Mm-hmm. Jamie, do you want to pipe in?
Yeah. So I'm just curious. Did you see any tracks from prey species, whether they be mice, or did you happen to notice any rabbit droppings in those deer trails?
No. There was the stuff. I mean, the only thing on the surface was tracks.
Yeah. So with the deep snow we've had, I noticed around we're on 5 acres out in the country as well. And the path that's plowed to our chicken coop or, to certain areas of our yard is well utilized by rabbits right now. And, it could be that they are on those trails and those birds of prey are taking advantage of something as large as a rabbit. So it could be an owl at night and those are leaving the wing marks. Or it could be metal voles or other things in the subnivian, that area underneath the snow but above the ground, that poke through and follow that trail for a little bit and become vulnerable. really hard to say, but in terms of the wing marks, I think you're right. Those are most likely going to be birds of prey. But, it could be, if there's any type of food around, it could be other things like crows or blue jays that are curious and are foraging around on the ground as well.
Thank you, Dave, for calling. Appreciate it. Liz in Wausau called to say she has a bird nest above their back door. It's a little inconvenient, but she's been able to walk around it. Is there a way to safely move it, or should she let it be? I'm guessing let it be for now anyway. But David,
Yeah, so the bird nest, it depends on if it has eggs in it or not. If it has eggs in it, then without a permit, she is prohibited from moving that nest or disturbing that nest in any way. But if it does not have eggs in it, she can destroy that nest and move it all she wants to. And I would suspect that you know, I'd be a little surprised if there's eggs in that nest at this time of the year. So she can do that. The one thing she might want to be just vigilant about is if a bird built a nest there the last nesting season, something may try to build a nest there again this nesting season. So just be aware and vigilant of that. And if you see a bird starting to build a nest there, destroy that nest as quickly as you can before eggs get deposited. And eventually the bird will go and find another place to nest. But again, once an egg is deposited in that nest without a permit, it is illegal to destroy or to disturb that nest.
Makes good sense. Denise emailed to say that the impact of wind turbines on bats could be devastating. And do we have any data on that?
Yeah, there's a lot of research that's been done with wind turbines and impacts relative to birds and bats. And bats do typically get more negatively impacted than birds do by and far. Primarily through mortality. So birds suffer a lot more mortality than birds do. And that is certainly a concern in terms of additive mortality. So mortality that would not typically happen to those bat species if the wind turbines weren't there. So that is an issue. And people have been looking at it pretty consistently as to what to do about it other than turning the turbines off or slowing down the what's called the cut-in speed. When the turbines actually start up or changing that cut-in speed, when bats are in the area actively feeding or migrating, there's not much else that can be done yet.
Not much yet, but they're working on it.
Yep.
Anne in Milwaukee called to ask, what recommendations do you have, both of you, to help support bats? I guess we've kind of covered a lot of what you can do.
Yeah, so there, I mean, if you do want to get active, you know, even involve your family or children and so on, you can volunteer for a couple of two different surveys that the department does, the acoustic survey and also the bat roost survey. And you can sign up on the DNR's website to do that. You can build a bat house using the designs that we talked about, you know, making sure you're building them specific to the state. And you could also donate. There's two different, you could donate money to help bat conservation. So there's two different funds that the DNR uses. One is in memory of Dave Riddell.
Dave Riddell.
Who is a bat researcher actually from the department David and I are in. And in his memory. And then there's another fund just for for resources that the bat ecologists need right now. So that's another option that you can do to help as well. And then just reporting observations. If you find a bat roost, you know, send them an email and make sure they have that one accounted for. That would be very helpful as well.
So lots of good information today. And here we are out of time. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Thanks. And we'll look forward to your next visit. You guys will be back May 5th. Thank you. David Drake and Jamie Knack, our guests today from the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. David is also with UW Extension as well. Great to have them back. Tomorrow, Bassam Shakashiri is back to talk about science and the Wisconsin Idea. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.